From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Snow is white gold for New Hampshire, and so with a big storm on the way, those in the winter recreation industry are pretty excited. New Hampshire has long marketed itself as a winter playground with skiing, snowshoeing, snowmobiling, ice fishing, even sled dog racing. But the season itself has been unreliable lately. It snows and then it rains, washing the snow away or turning it to ice. Downhill ski areas can make the white stuff, but not if it's 65 degrees like it was last week. And for Nordic skiers, snowshoers, and snowmobilers, it's natural snow or nothing. But warmer winters are more than just disappointing for recreation. The environment is also affected by weird winters, disrupting the life cycles of trees, plants, and soils, the quality of our water, and the health of animals. Today in Exchange, what's up with winter? Let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll bring several voices into our conversation today. With us for the hour is Elizabeth Burakowski, Research Assistant Professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. Elizabeth, thank you very much for helping us out. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So a lot of listeners might be thinking, Elizabeth, what are you talking about? The decline of winter. We've got a big storm on the way. Lots of snow predicted. I've got one person in my house who is already planning his ski trip. What's the wider trend here, Elizabeth?
The wider trend is that our winter temperatures have been warming, and warming considerably. We just got the numbers in for winter 2017-18, and remarkably, it was 2.4 degrees warmer than our 20th century average. So this is concerning. This has an impact on the number of days that we actually have natural snow cover. It affects the amount of precipitation we receive as rain instead of snow. And we start seeing our lakes ice out earlier, our rivers discharge earlier, and our snowfall trends tend to be a bit mixed. We end up getting more rain than we do snow.
So I saw in one of the pieces of research that you did, Elizabeth, that actually big snow dumps, like we might get tomorrow, are actually part of this warming trend. Again, it's hard for people to understand that.
Right. So we're going to have snow as long as temperatures remain below freezing. And what we see, though, is a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. So as long as you have the right conditions of cold air and warm air, warm moisture-laden air mixing together, we can get these really big snowstorms. However, the trends in the future are not suggesting that they will increase very much. We'll actually see a decrease in seasonal snowfall as we move forward in time.
So what do you measure, Elizabeth? What's the most concerning data point that you look at? Is it, you know, number of days during the winter where temperatures are above freezing? Is it the number of days in the winter that there's no snow on the ground? What's that one data point that you really focus on?
For me, it's temperature. Temperature is going to dictate the phase of water. What I really want is frozen water, something that's in the form of snow. And what we're seeing is much warmer temperatures. And we've seen an increase of about a degree to even 4 degrees since 1970, depending on where you are in the state. Also concerning is that our nighttime temperatures have warmed much more than our daytime. And this makes it harder for us to, say, make snow in the wintertime at a ski resort. And I'm also very concerned about whether that snow stays on the ground. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, we've been trying our hardest to measure snow, and it's actually been quite snow-free as of late. But we're very excited to see some more snow tomorrow.
So you look at temperature and understood, because that's the primary thing that affects the snow and the ice. You said that the temperature has increased 4 degrees in some parts of New Hampshire since the 1970s, not that long ago. There's a map that is out there that you sent us earlier that looks at temperature changes across New England. We've got it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, and folks should definitely take a look at it. But just give us a sense now on air, Elizabeth, of what you find from looking at this temperature map about New England and the Northeast.
What we see is that New England in particular is warming much faster than the rest of the U.S. The Midwest can also get lumped into that group. We're seeing warmer winter temperatures in these regions, whereas in the western U.S. it's warming, but not nearly as fast.
Why is that, Elizabeth?
Well, we think it has a lot to do with our disappearance of snow cover. When you lose snow cover, that can also decrease how much of the sun's energy gets reflected, meaning the surface can absorb much more of the sun's energy. And when it absorbs it, it starts heating up. And that can cause what we call a positive feedback loop, in which a initial warming trend gets amplified or enhanced by the effect of the loss of snow cover.
I see. So winter warms, there's less snow, and that snow in and of itself keeps things cooler. It's like having a, you know, open refrigerator.
Yeah, it's like wearing a white t-shirt on a hot summer day. If you have a white t-shirt over the landscape, it's going to stay cooler.
I want our listeners to join us with their questions and comments, and then a lot more questions for you, Elizabeth, about some of the recreation impacts, but also what you call ecosystem services that winter provides. The number for you to join us right now is 1-800-892-6477. So here's the question for you, our listeners. Have you seen winter changes? What do those changes look like in your community? Or if you have not seen winter change, we'd love to hear from you too. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Give us your observations, thoughts, questions about winter, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. So, Elizabeth, you touched on this, but I want to ask you a little bit more. One of the frustrations for the skiers in our lives is that it snows, you get all excited, and you spend many hours shoveling, and then it goes away. It rains. Why is it seems so often lately that snow is followed by rain?
Well, this is a trend that we've been seeing and scientists have identified in the New England region. Recently, Climate Central had reported that 80% of New Hampshire weather stations are now reporting a greater proportion of winter precipitation falling as rain instead of snow. And this has a lot to do with our atmospheric conditions. If we don't have a warm enough atmosphere to support snowfall, we're going to see that moisture come down as rain instead. And like you had alluded to, this affects our snowpacks. I'm not a huge fan of skiing on snowpack that's been inundated with rain. It can turn into a bit of an ice rink if you do that.
Right. And a little bit later in the hour, we'll talk to Jessica Keeler at Ski New Hampshire about how ski areas, especially the Nordic areas, because they can't really make snow, are responding. Again, you can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So what's the economic impact, Elizabeth, of these less wintry winters? How do you measure it?
Well, what we've looked at in a recent report that I published with a group called Protect Our Winters is that in New Hampshire, we supported about 2.1 million skier visits on average between the years 2001 and 2016. We then looked at our lowest 5 years and compared those to average years, and we found a 12% decrease in skier visitation, which meant that we supported 800 fewer jobs and also saw a 47.9 million decrease in the amount of economic activity that we were seeing in the state of New Hampshire.
So 12% decrease in skier visits between what time periods again, please?
This was comparing our lowest 5 years over the period 2001 to 2016 to the average visitation.
And when you say skier visits, do you mean downhill or do you mean Nordic as well?
This is downhill visitation specifically.
What about Nordic? Do we have numbers on that or what are the concerns around that sport?
We haven't looked at the Nordic numbers in this specific analysis, but we would expect to see probably stronger decreases in visitation during those tougher years, such as winter 2015-16. That was a particularly low snow cover year.
So you look at the skier visits and how they've gone down in terms of downhill skiing. How do you measure, Elizabeth, sort of, for lack of a better way to put it, lack of interest? You know, somebody thinks, oh, I might like to try Nordic, but boy, the last couple of years it's been kind of skiing on rocks, so why bother? Is that measurable?
It is measurable. You have to survey people, and there are folks at the University of New Hampshire who do exactly that. Back in 2007, our own Larry Hamilton here at University of New Hampshire had published a study that looked at demand for skiing and found that it wasn't just the snowfall that's up in the mountains or even just the amount of trails that were open, but it was actually having snow or snowfall in your backyard. So folks from Boston who are coming up to New Hampshire to come skiing are more motivated to ski if they've had snowfall in their backyard within the past couple days.
Even if they get like half an inch in their backyard, it gets them excited to get out and do something.
It certainly does. And that's true for me as well. It's harder for me to get motivated if I don't see snow in my backyard.
Well, and again, we'll talk to Ski NH about the backyard effect. And I know they're trying to work against that. You know, Elizabeth, we've talked a lot about data, numbers, snowpack, precipitation, temperature, dollars spent or not spent on skiing. I'd love to ask you just a personal question. I mean, how do you experience winter differently now than, say, 15, 20 years ago?
Well, it can be very disconcerting as a research scientist and even just as a mom and as someone who's been living in New Hampshire since the late 80s. It can be tough to go out to my field site and be attempting to measure snow. And when there's no snow out there in the middle of February, it can be downright, I mean, it's to be honest, depressing. It makes me sad. And what also makes me really worried about this is that I know as a scientist that we're not hitting a plateau. We're not going to see this trend reverse anytime soon. And in fact, we're kind of on an escalator. This is going to continue to warm. And we're not going to see this train slow down unless some really immediate and aggressive action is taken to reduce carbon emissions and to reduce carbon dioxide in our atmosphere.
You sound really bummed out.
I am some days. And other days, I become very positive. I also teach here at the University of New Hampshire, and some of my students in my gen ed class are some of the most optimistic and innovative and thoughtful students I've ever had, and they're interested in solutions. They want to be part of the solution.
How do we know that it's an escalator and not a plateau?
We know this from historical observations, and we also know this from climate models. So when we project into the future, we use climate models that are physically based representations of our climate system, and we can see that regardless of our action right now, we're probably going to continue seeing warming well into the future. And only the most immediate and aggressive actions to reduce carbon dioxide in our atmosphere are going to help limit the warming.
How reliable are those models, Elizabeth? Because some people have questioned some of the inputs and assumptions in those models, thereby questioning the outputs that you know for sure you're on this escalator as you describe it.
Right. And I disagree. That is not supported by the science. The science demonstrates that the models have actually been quite accurate in predicting and projecting how temperatures have warmed in the past and how they're going to warm in the future.
Where does that science come from? Who's doing it?
There are many groups across the globe who are doing this type of research. Within the United States, the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory, all of these institutions support different models that represent the physics slightly differently, but they all come to the same conclusion, that our winters are going to continue to warm and that we're going to continue to see fewer days with snow cover, more winter precipitation falling as rain instead of snow, and an overall shorter snow season.
Well, and again, we'll talk with Ski NH in a moment about the economic impact. I want to ask you, Elizabeth, about the environmental impact, because you've written, even if you're a person who does not like winter, even if you spend your whole winter in Florida, you get what you call ecosystem services from winter. So what are ecosystem services, Elizabeth?
Yeah, ecosystem services, it's not my term per se. It was coined during the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, so that was published back in 2005. And it's the benefits that we get from our ecosystems when they're functioning naturally and properly. And what is happening is that human activities are disrupting their natural functioning. So if you consider, say, the Western United States or even the Eastern United States, when we have a snowpack and that starts to melt in the spring, it becomes a critical part of our ecosystem in terms of delivering moisture and water into, say, the Gulf of Maine. When we have our spring freshet or that pulse of meltwater, it's a really big mechanism to transport nutrients through our ecosystems. And for me, when I think about what our winters might look like in the future, and if we don't have that spring pulse, that could severely disrupt the availability of nutrients to our ecosystems.
So give us a little bit more on that, because some people may not understand the sort of systems that you're talking about. Obviously, the snow always melts in the springtime and feeds our water systems. But why is it important to have that melt as snow and not just more water? I mean, some people might think, well, water is water, so who cares if it's snow or rain?
Right. And if we did see a pulse of, say, rainfall in the spring, maybe the function wouldn't be disrupted as much. But if you have, say, some insects that are going to respond to the availability of nutrients in, say, a stream, that's going to then cascade into the availability of food for, say, fish in that stream and the spawning that results from that. And when we disrupt that, we can really offset the timing of when certain organisms are interacting. It's an offset in phenology is what they call it, the tracking of natural events that occur in the springtime and fall and throughout the year.
Can you give us an example about, you know, a particular insect or bug whose normal cycle is to do X, but now that everything's melting sooner or not even snowing, the insect does Y?
I don't have a specific insect in mind, but I am thinking more like along the lines of when you think about when trees start leafing out with their canopy. At that point in the spring, the ones that are responding to temperature, if we see, say, a magnolia tree start blooming in the middle of March or even February, and then all of a sudden a big snow event comes, it could kill those blooms. And any insects that, bees perhaps, that might be reliant on that bloom are then going to show up in April and be wondering, where are those blooms?
I see. So the tree is supposed to bloom at a certain point. It blooms earlier or later or not at all, and the bees show up and they say, where's my food supply?
Right, right.
And then everything is disrupted. And we've done tons of programs about how important bees are. We have some listeners, Elizabeth, calling in, sending us emails with their questions or comments. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. And I'm really pushing the email because we are having some phone problems today. So don't give us a call right now. Send us an email instead. We love your questions, comments, observations about our changing winters here in New England. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Tricia sent us an email. She says, I live in Portsmouth. I'm a gardener by trade, and I used to start my season in mid to late May. That was only about 5 years ago. Now, she says, I'm getting out there in mid-March due to the warmer springs and early thaws. So that's an impact that Tricia sees. You know, for years, Elizabeth, the advice that I have followed in my meager gardening has been don't plant until after Labor Day. But sometimes I feel like that's not such good advice. What do you think?
There has been an overall trend for the lengthening of the growing season, and this is occurring at both ends of the season. So we're seeing an earlier start to spring and a later start to winter. And we might think, oh, that's great. We could actually maybe grow some more food in this region. But it's also highly variable. So while we may be tempted to plant our gardens in mid-March when we get that really nice warm spell, there still is a risk of frost. But that could change considerably in the future, especially 40 to 50 years out.
Well, and the temperatures do seem more erratic. So it might be beautiful on March 31st, but you might get a frost, on April 1st. There was an April Fool's snowstorm just last year. So if you had planted at the end of March, your plants would not be very happy to be covered with a lot of snow. Thank you for that email, Tricia. And I encourage you to especially send email because, again, we're having some phone problems. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments about changing winter here in New Hampshire and New England. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And coming up, we'll talk to the head of Ski New Hampshire about how warming winters are affecting that industry. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hi, I'm Jessica Hunt. I'm a producer for The Exchange. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I'm really excited because I am getting to put together a retrospective about Something Wild. That's another podcast on NHPR. You'll hear it during Morning Edition on Friday mornings. They have been doing that for 20 years, and I am delighted to be able to put together a special episode of The Exchange about something wild and their time on the air. But I'm coming to you because I need your help. I need to hear your memories, things that have touched you over the years about something wild. Here's the phone number to leave a voicemail, 603-513-7797. Thanks a lot.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the winter blues, how unpredictable winter weather is impacting tourism and our environment. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We want your comments, questions, personal observations about some of the changes you have seen in our winter season. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. With us for the hour, Elizabeth Burakowski, Research Assistant Professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. Joining us by phone right now is Jessica Keeler, Executive Director at Ski New Hampshire, a statewide association that represents the 33 alpine and cross-country ski areas in the state. And Jessica, a big welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
So we were talking earlier, you must be jumping up and down with excitement over the weather forecast.
Pretty much, yeah. As soon as we get off the phone, I will be doing that happy dance.
And you've probably been doing it all winter, trying to make it snow, do your snow dance. I want to talk about downhill in a moment, Jessica, but as a cross-country skier myself, and Concord is a big area for cross-country skiers, lots of people do it in this area. Our high school ski team and middle school ski team are great. So lots of interest in this area anyway about cross-country skiing. How are those areas doing in recent years, given the sort of wacky snow cover that we've had?
Well, you know, I'd say they're doing about as you would expect. Those areas that don't have snowmaking, you know, they definitely are challenged by the weather. They benefit when we get those big snowfall events, and they tend to suffer more when we get more rain or when we get the really warm weather and the snow melts. But, you know, they're also good at adapting, too. So I know that there's, you know, lots of times ski area operators refer to themselves as snow farmers. So they get very creative about how they groom the snow, how they protect it, and, you know, just being very innovative, you know, coming up with innovative ways to try and protect the surface as best they can. But it, you know, you're right. It is. It can be a challenge when the weather's not cooperating.
Yeah, it was 65, close to 70 degrees in parts of New Hampshire just recently. And then these snowfalls are followed by rain, and that washes away all the snow. So the cross-country ski areas are trying their best to snow farm. I'm trying to picture how that happens. Also, how are they sort of becoming multi-use areas, you know, horseback riding or mountain biking or golf or whatever?
Yeah, you're right. You know, a lot of areas have welcomed fat biking, which, as I assume you know, but, you know, it's basically a modified mountain bike with really thick tires that allows them to bike through snow that may not be suitable for cross-country skiers. And then also mountain biking, you know, when the snow has melted is another use. Snowshoeing is certainly something that they can use those trails for as well. And, you know, and certainly hiking, you know, those are different uses for cross-country trails.
Yeah, although snowshoeing on rocks is not that much fun, but...
True. Well, so you can get your micro spikes.
Yeah. So one last question about Nordic, and then I do have a lot of questions, Jessica, about downhill. Among the Nordic community, how much are you hearing a fear that fewer people are just going to want to get into this sport? It's just too unreliable. Why buy the equipment, you know, if I just don't think I'm going to be able to use it? It rains too much.
You know, I haven't really been hearing about a fear so much. I think there's more of a frustration with the weather, you know, when it's not cooperating. But, you know, let's take the Olympics, for example, you know, with the U.S. women's team who just won the race, you know, that brings a lot of attention to the sport and gets people really interested and excited. So things like that can definitely help boost the sport. You know, I think it's our job, you know, not just Ski New Hampshire, but all of our ski areas, you know, we work to try and convince people to take up the sport because it's not, it's something that's good for you. You know, it's like getting outside, being active, leading a healthy lifestyle. And, you know, those are some great messages that we can put out there. And I think that we continue to do that. I think our cross-country ski areas continue to do that. And, you know, just, again, trying to get people off the couch and kids especially, start them young so that they adopt it at a young age and continue to do it throughout their lives.
Well, let's talk about downhill skiing and the downhill ski areas who have the advantage of being able to make snow. What are you hearing from them, Jessica, this year?
Well, you know, it's been a challenging year. You know, we've talked, you know, you guys have been talking a little bit about the rain, snow events. You know, we actually started the year with a really cold snap, you know, during the Christmas holidays, and we had some fantastic snow, but people didn't want to ski so much because it was so cold.
Right. That was frustrating.
It was, yeah. you know, and then we have had some of the warmer weather events, too, with some snow followed by rain and those kinds of events. And that has been challenging. What does help a lot of the alpine areas is the fact that they do start making snow in the fall and they build that base up, you know, so that we can, you know, kind of weather those bad weather events, you know, better than a lot of the cross-country areas. Some cross-country areas do have snowmaking, but I don't think it's quite as prevalent as it is for the alpine areas.
Well, it seems like it would be hugely expensive because you've got to cover such a wide area. So how warm is too warm to make snow? Again, I was thinking about you guys, you know, last week or the week before when it was 65.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely too warm.
Yeah.
Well, around 28 degrees is what you're looking at, and it kind of depends on the humidity level as well. So the lower humidity, the better, you know, for making snow. When it tends to be too humid, that makes it a little harder, so you need to have lower temperatures.
So what variations have you seen, Jessica, based on geography? For example, central New Hampshire versus the Whites versus north of the Notches. I mean, mm-hmm. I sometimes feel for the snow mountains in central New Hampshire, whereas, you know, up in the Whites, it's fine. They've got lots of snow.
Yeah, you know, that can, you know, the geography of different areas can definitely have an impact. I've seen that as well, where there have been times when some of the northern areas or higher elevation areas have colder temperatures, which are, you know, better for making snow. Sometimes they're getting more snow. But that can vary as well. We've seen storms that have come up from the coast that maybe don't touch the northern areas as much as they have some of the southern areas. So it really varies, and it depends a lot on where the weather is coming from.
You know, Elizabeth Borkowski, I want to bring you in just for just a second. Jessica was talking about, you know, trying to get people excited to try Nordic skiing, to, you know, try downhill skiing. But when the weather is, you know, and the snow seems to continually get washed out, there may be people who are dedicated may go ahead and do it, but those who are sort of on the fence, or as Jessica said, on the couch, may need some convincing. You've been quoted, Elizabeth, as saying, "My biggest concern is back-to-back warm winters. If you have a series of 3 to 4 winters that are all terrible, it's going to be really hard to keep people interested in the sport." Elizabeth, to you, and Jessica, maybe you want to jump in too, but Elizabeth, you first, what's the process there where, you know, winter after winter, people start to fade, their interest fades?
Well, I think what happens is that it becomes a trade-off. You know, how much are you willing to pay to continue enjoying the sport you love? And what's that trade-off with the conditions that you're enjoying it in? I've found this with my own life, that I've had a harder time getting out to go skiing. I've also been trying to reduce my carbon footprint, so I've been more earning my turns by doing some more backcountry. And backcountry is much more challenging in those marginal snow years. So it can be harder to get motivated. You're also competing against other activities. So if it's 75 and sunny in Boston, folks might be much more interested in taking a bike ride locally or enjoying the time out on the beach or taking some time to play some tennis or golf. And it can make it very difficult for people to stay motivated and stay invested in the sport.
Yeah, I had that choice myself recently when it was so nice. I went for a bike ride instead of, you know, getting in the car, driving where there was snow so that I could cross country ski. And I got an email to that effect from Kevin, and I'll share this with you, Jessica. I'd love your response. Kevin says, in the current climate where you need a full-time job or multiple part-time jobs just to afford to live in New Hampshire, not many young people can afford to go skiing. With your data on reduced ski visitation, what was the price increase of an average day ticket over the same period? Kevin, thank you for the email. And Jessica, this has to do with adaptation. Given that winter is less predictable and, you know, there's more of a chance that the snow might be icy or crusty, How do ski areas draw people in? Could they draw people in with reduced prices, as Kevin suggests?
Well, I would say that over the last few years, I've seen different ski areas getting kind of creative with the types of products that they're offering. While all ski areas still offer, kind of your typical season pass for people who are committed to a particular area, a lot of ski areas have also started offering different kinds of products that allow, some more flexibility, whether it's like a 5-pack or a 10-pack type product, or where you can get passes that are transferable. So if you can't use it, you can give it to your, friend or a family member or something like that. And there is also different times of the season, too, like whether it's early season or late season, where the ticket prices often drop, or you might buy a season pass and get some extra passes that you can give to friends and family members to, encourage them to come join you. So I think that there's a recognition that also that the demographics are changing, that people are looking at doing things differently than they used to 10, 20 years ago, and the ski areas are trying to adapt to that with how they create and price products.
Yeah, among my own friend group, there's some sort of joking about, oh, you bought a ski pass 2 years ago, too bad, because it was a bad winter. So you just kind of, you buy it and you cross your fingers and hope for a good winter. We did a program recently, Jessica, I think you heard it, on backcountry skiing and how that is the fastest growing area of the ski industry. People getting out, it was a really fun show, people getting out and hiking up a mountain and then skiing down. Earning your turns, as Elizabeth said earlier. How has the lack of natural snowfall affected that popular, fast-growing segment of your industry?
Well, I can't really speak to that because we don't, Ski New Hampshire doesn't really track that so much. But
right.
I can say that, the ski areas, a lot of them do have uphill policies as well, and they'll sell like a discounted ticket or have different programs for people who want to skin up the hill and ski down as well. So they're definitely recognizing that there's a growing interest in that and are working to accommodate those folks as well, while also trying to keep the rest of everyone safe, because you definitely want to make sure that you're not dealing with collisions or that sort of thing. So they've come up with ways that places where if you're going to hike up the hill, this is where you should go. Usually at a reduced cost.
I also know, Jessica, that ski areas have done a lot in recent years to expand their mountains as four-season places to go. A couple years ago, I actually got on one of those little sleds that you go down, the little wooden sleds of the trek. Thank you. Yes, it was a lot of fun. Weddings, hiking, mountain biking. How does all that other stuff that the areas have had to do compare to the money that comes in from good old-fashioned skiing?
I would say we don't collect revenue numbers here, but I do think it's becoming more and more important to the year-round operations of ski areas. A lot of ski areas also attract a different demographic during the summer. You get people who in the winter are coming, they might be season pass holders, or they just have plans to ski throughout the winter. And in the summer, you get like the sort of casual visitor, someone who might just be coming up to New Hampshire for the weekend or, something like that. But the resorts have definitely recognized that there are those opportunities for attracting more visitors, making more revenue. And so they've been expanding the offerings that they have, whether it is mountain coasters or canopy tours, treetop climbing courses, and all different manner of things. And honestly, it makes a lot of sense, too, because the infrastructure is there. You have lodges with bathrooms and restaurants. You have employees as well. And this gives them an opportunity to have more year-round employment. So it's kind of a win-win, for the ski areas, for the employees, and also for people who are coming up to visit the mountains anyway in the summer.
Elizabeth, you've looked at the big areas and how they've adapted, as Jessica says, to stay in business and doing things from, zip lines to mountain coasters and so forth. What about your predictions for the small ski areas, Elizabeth? You've had some thoughts there.
Yeah, it's much harder for a low elevation or more southerly resort to continue to adapt to warmer winters if they can't keep snow on the ground. And this is specific to skier visitation. But having these four season events, being able to visit the resort even when it's not snowy, is certainly going to be a huge adaptation strategy. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I've been really encouraged by seeing how many resorts are offering weddings. I went to one of my friend's weddings was at Pat's Peak, where I learned to snowboard. And it was delightful to be there in the fall to see the fall foliage and be able to ride up the chairlift and enjoy that type of scenery that wasn't even a snow season.
Well, a couple last questions for you, Jessica, and then we'll let you go. Because, again, with the snowstorm coming, I know this is a busy day for you. Nationally, ski areas say they're trying to do their part not to contribute more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. They're trying to run their mountains sustainably. What are some of the major efforts or investments that New Hampshire ski areas are making?
Yeah, there's a number of them. I mean, one of the biggest, most obvious ones is the snowmaking systems themselves. Snowmaking systems have become more and more efficient over the years, and the resorts spend a lot of money, you know, replacing the snow guns, the compressors, and the other components that go into having those snowmaking systems. So that's a big one right there. There's also, you know, efforts to purchase more fuel-efficient groomers, other efforts like, you know, establishing idle-free drop-off zones or installing electric car charging stations, even, you know, replacing light bulbs and those kinds of things that make the buildings themselves more efficient. Those are some of the things that the ski areas are doing, but I would say that the biggest one is, you know, making the snowmaking systems more efficient.
Well, last question for you, Jessica, and again, thank you for being generous with your time. What keeps the head of Ski NH up at night? I think I can guess, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, I would have to say it is the weather. You know, we definitely are concerned, you know, when we have winters like this where we see a lot of, you know, the warming trends, the rain events, you know, we get the snow and then it's followed by the rain. You know, that just bums us out and we wonder, okay, how are we going to convince people to come up and ski? How are the ski areas going to fare? Are they going to be able to last... you know, stay open until, you know, the end of March or the middle of April. You know, they all have varying end dates. And, you know, it's something that we know that our industry is very resilient. They're innovative and they're always coming up with ways to, you know, protect what they have and make it better. But, you know, there are concerns as to, you know, are people going to keep coming, you know, especially if down in Boston or even in Concord it's 70 degrees. You know, so we're always trying to figure out how we can get people to keep coming to visit us.
Yeah, if you're devoted, then you'll be devoted and you'll ski over the rocks and in the slush. But
sure.
If you're sort of on the fence, then you might decide, nah, I think I'll just stay home. Jessica, good luck with this storm coming. I know this is great
news for
you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Jessica Keeler, Executive Director at Ski New Hampshire, a statewide association that represents the state's 33 alpine and cross-country ski areas. You can send us an email and we will share it after a break. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Elizabeth, heading into the break, I just want to share with you a bunch of emails we've gotten from gardeners who've noticed the changing seasons. Richard says, I've been gardening here at my Amherst, New Hampshire home since the 80s. There has been a huge change, Richard says, in the first fall killing frost. In the 80s, the first frost was usually mid or late September. Now the first frost is often Halloween or later. Richard, thank you for that. Mike says he's a farmer. He says he inextricably is linked to weather and climate. There are many plants, Mike says, that enter a state of dormancy to successfully overwinter and remain that way until soil temperatures coax them out at a date that will make them less susceptible to cold damage. Mike says, if you have a peach tree, you know the danger. He says, last year we had a very warm weather in February, near 70 for about 2 weeks, followed by temperatures that plunged into the minus 10 degree range. Mike says many of the berry bushes I grew were damaged, cost us a significant amount of money. Mike and Richard, thank you for the emails. Keep those emails coming, exchange@nhpr.org. And coming up, we will talk to a tree expert in New Hampshire about how the weird winter weather we've been having lately is affecting maple syrup and our state's forests. All that coming up, stay with us.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhbr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Steve Marchand, so far the only candidate to challenge Governor Sununu for re-election. Send us your questions for Mr. Marchand before the show to exchange at nhpr.org. This hour, we're looking at how unpredictable winters of recent years affect our ecosystem, our state tourism. We've talked a lot about the ski industry. Send us your thoughts right now. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Here's the question that we're asking you this hour. How have you seen winter change here in the state? Again, email exchange at nhpr.org. Elizabeth Burakowski with UNH is joining us for the hour. And Elizabeth, tons of questions coming in from our listeners. So let's go back to them. And Rick joins us from Loudoun. Hi, Rick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Rick.
I'm actually in Concord now.
Oh, okay.
I've been plowing commercial parking lots for, well, gee, since the middle of the 1980s. And I've seen, you know, like this winter, like nothing. Last February, for 5 days in a row, we got 16 inches of snow every day.
So that was a heavy one.
That was, yeah, that was, yeah. I don't think I got out of the truck for, you know, other than to grab a cup of coffee, you know.
Thank goodness Dunkin' Donuts has the drive-thru, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what have you seen? You've been driving a plow truck since the 80s. That's really interesting. I just wonder what you've noticed over that time.
That this global warming thing, I don't get it. You know, this winter will be, you know, like nothing. Last winter was crazy for a month. It's just the way it is. It's cyclical.
And do you feel like that's always been the case, Rick, or do you feel like the sort of wackiness has increased in recent years?
No, I don't think so. I saw a snowstorm on where everybody goes out trick-or-treating.
Oh, yes, Snowtober. I remember that. Yeah,
yeah,
I think it was 2010.
Yeah, you know, 16 inches of snow in 4 hours.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the winter was like June.
Yeah.
You know? Sorry. You know?
Well, it's great to hear from you because, you know, who's looking at snow cover more than a ski area owner or a plow guy. So I really appreciate you calling in, Rick. And, you know, Elizabeth, this raises the point that we talked about before. It's not that we don't have cold weather. It's not that we don't have freezing cold weather. It's not that we don't get big dumps of snow. It's that it's more erratic. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, we've been seeing a very consistent trend towards warmer temperatures since the 1970s and even since the beginning of the 20th century. This is a very consistent trend, and we will see erratic responses from the atmosphere. So when we have a warmer atmosphere, it will hold more moisture. So it will still snow as long as we have temperatures that are below freezing. However, our trends are not showing an increase in the days with snow cover. In other words, we can get a big dump, but it's just going to melt when we get above freezing.
So that's what you look at in response to people who say, look, first of all, New England's always has had crazy weather, right? There's that old saying, if you want to, you know, find out what the weather is in New England, wait 5 minutes. So it's always been crazy weather, and we still will get snow. But you're saying, you know, look at the number of days with the snow on the ground. Don't look at the inches received. Look at the number of days where that snow is still sticking around. Is that what's important?
Exactly. And we can look for consistent signals through other indicators. So, for example, if you've been ice fishing, you might have noticed since the beginning of, you know, about the 1950s or so, that our lakes are icing out 1 to 2 weeks earlier in the spring than they had been in the past. This is consistent with warmer temperatures. So in addition to seeing fewer days with snow cover, we're also seeing our lakes ice out earlier. We're also seeing the start of spring earlier as well. So the timing of when leaves are coming out and when plants are sprouting, that is also advancing in response to temperature. And well, the same is true of snowfall.
Kind of like Mike, our farmer, who emailed us earlier and talked about, you know, losing a fair bit of berry bushes because they started to leaf out when it got really warm in February, and then the temperature dropped again. And he said he lost a significant amount of money from that. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, someone else who's been looking at the impact on plants, specifically trees. Stephen Roberge is with us on the line. He's Natural Resources Field Specialist at UNH Cooperative Extension. And Stephen Roberge, a big welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
So what changes have you seen in New Hampshire forests broadly since you've been studying them over time?
Yeah, so my career is fairly short, but you know, if we look at the data that specifically Hubbard Brook has been researching and looking at, we've seen a steady decline in snow cover throughout the years, especially since the 1950s, and also the depth of the snowpack. So it's nothing new here. And then, you know, speaking with sugar makers that I work with quite often, we're finding that the tapping, the time of when they go out and tap maple trees, like to harvest sap, is actually getting earlier and earlier, you know, closer into January.
So I know what Hubbard Brook is, but just remind listeners what that is.
Oh, sure. It's a research facility that has several watersheds that's run by the U.S. Forest Service that looks at long-term trends and long-term studies on how our forests grow, the soil profile, how nutrients flow through watersheds and hydrology.
So it's basically a forest where you guys collect all sorts of data about the health of our forests.
Yeah, it'd be a living laboratory.
So what about the health of the trees, Stephen? Because, you know, somebody might think, hey, is it possible trees would be even stronger and happier because they'll have a longer growing season if winter is shorter?
Yeah, and so, you know, what we're finding is that, you know, that lack of snowpack really kind of extends the spring season, let's say. But trees are, they start leafing out and growing by a couple things. One of them is temperature, so earlier temperatures may mean earlier leaf out. But they also focus on the photo period as well. So that has not changed as the climate changes. And so, the you know, when it's dark, it's dark, and when it's light, it's light. And that has nothing to do with climate.
So that kind of messes them up because it's warmer and they think, oh, it's spring. I know I'm talking about trees here. But then the light obviously stays the same year to year. So does that kind of mess with them?
I wouldn't say it messes with them, but it can, you know, it can mess up some other dynamics that are going on in the forest. And so with that, that longer spring where you have more ground that's exposed to the sunlight, that will warm up and that activates a lot of the biota, the you know, microbes and things living in the soil. And they'll start to break down soil and release nutrients. And historically, that would occur at the same time that trees were starting to leaf out and become active and the roots were taking up nutrients. But what you can see is that there's kind of a miss of nutrients where they're essentially leached out of the system because the trees aren't available to take them up because they hadn't woken up from their winter nap.
That's interesting. Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong. So there's less snow cover. The ground is a little bit warmer, so things start to happen. The leaves haven't come out yet because the sun can just beat down directly on that ground. Now there's no snow keeping it colder, and things start to happen in the soil in terms of the nutrients that the trees need, but the trees aren't ready to suck that up yet.
Exactly, yeah.
And so when it is time for them to suck it up, as they wake up from their nap, as you said, there's not as much left for them to feed on.
Yeah, there may be some you know, some leaching of nitrogen and things like that that once was, you know, historically was available, is now no longer, or maybe just further down the slope or actually into streams or into our waterways.
Wow, that's really interesting. Speaking of trees, I also read recently that beech trees are starting to dominate in the northeastern woodlands. Now, why is that, Stephen?
I'm not overly familiar with that specific study, but, you know, in my my region, we do see an increase in beech as well, or a heavy dominance of beech, especially in the understory of the forest. And, you know, a lot of it can be accounted to sometimes us by cutting the forest. We can promote beech, not just by accident. But also, you know, beech is a tree species that deer do not browse at all. They don't favor it. They'll actually eat sugar maple over beech. And so if given the choice, and there's some beech saplings and some maple saplings, the deer will actually browse and sometimes kill the maple, and then the beech will just grow up and into the forest.
I see. So we have less of those beautiful maples that draw tourists and more beech trees that people don't care as much about. I mean, are beech trees, you know, unlovable? I mean, what's the problem with beech trees?
Oh, well, beech trees are great, but, you know, like anything, we want diversity in our forest. And,
sure.
And, you know, if you have a understory that's completely filled with beech, it can be a problem. From a timber perspective, beech trees are, they have a lower quality of timber or lumber, makes great firewood, but, you know, it's very difficult wood to dry in the kiln drying process. And also, it is affected with what we call the beech bark disease. It's a fungus that actually affects the health and the quality of the wood and sometimes causes the trees to actually just snap off in the forest.
So here we are in March, maple sugar season. I was at a sugar shack myself last week, and the sap seemed to be flowing fine. What are the ideal conditions for the sap to flow, Stephen?
Yeah, so the ideal conditions is really that pull between winter and spring. So in the evening, in the nighttime, you want those freezing temperatures down into the low 20s, even into the teens. And then during the day, you want that nice, clear, bright sky, that warm sun coming down onto the trees just to thaw them out and get the sap flowing. So, you know, so 20s at night, 40s during the day. That dynamic allows for sap to build up in the tree and creates pressure inside the tree and allows for the sap to flow out.
So how have conditions been this year for the maple sugar farmers?
Yeah, I'd say it's decent, at least where I am. I'm in the southern part of the state, and so the further north, it's, you know, obviously it's a little more colder. And actually further north, there's, you know, a little more snow out there as well. You know, in my woods, there's actually no snow whatsoever on the ground. And, you know, that, you know, for all the reasons that you discussed earlier, that can have a lot of problems. But, you know, we've had a couple days that were in the 60s, the mid-60s, and those are the things that keep me up at night, just worrying about the season being shortened by those really hot days. But fortunately, it was able to drop back down to cooler temperatures.
So you're kind of like Jessica Keeler from Ski NH, where you're just watching the thermometer all winter long. Stephen, last thoughts that you want to share with our listeners about some of the changes or concerns that you have about the health of New Hampshire forests in a changing winter climate?
Oh, sure. One point I'll make out is that, you know, trees are very resilient. They're on the landscape for decades, if not centuries. So they've experienced a lot of things over their lifetime. But, you know, a changing climate, especially in a way that negatively impacts them, is just one way, just one added stress that these trees may face. So, you know, it's usually not one thing that kills a tree. It's several stresses that build up over time, whether it's insect or climate stress or soil deficiencies and things like that. But for the most part, you know, we do see trees in fairly good shape. But again, it's just these stresses that build over time that concerns us. And then the second thing as well is snow, you know, in the sugar bush is very important for sugaring too, is that nice insulating blanket that protects the tree roots. And with the loss of that snowpack over time can definitely add stress to the sugar maples.
Yeah, that's what I've gotten this hour from you and Elizabeth, is the importance of snowpack, not just because snow is fun, but for the soil health, for the plants that rely on that soil health, and so forth. Stephen, really good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Stephen Roberge, Natural Resources Field Specialist at UNH Cooperative Extension. Elizabeth, just a couple minutes left, and I'd love to share some of these emails that have come in with you. Donovan says, hiking in the woods of Amherst last week and found 4 ticks on me after. Gary also says, I am 63, have been backcountry skiing for 40 years, have seen winters begin later and sooner with the same attributes you've mentioned. And now I see ticks in the North Country when we never had them. New Hampshire has one of the highest incidences of Lyme disease in North America. A colleague of mine, Elizabeth, told me that her dog came back from a walk recently with some ticks. I thought at least we could get a break from these nasty creatures for a couple months.
When I hear about the ticks, it makes my skin crawl.
Literally, right.
It really does. And as a mom of a toddler, I fear for the day that I take him out and I find a tick on him. Mm. It hasn't happened yet, which is very interesting considering we're in the seacoast and it's a bit of a hotbed for ticks right now. But this is something that's going to be continuing to become more of a problem as temperatures warm. If we don't have those super cold days and nights to kill off these larvae and keep their populations in check, we're going to continue to see them in greater numbers and more frequently throughout the winter when we're just not used to seeing them.
Well, and when it was absolutely freezing cold for at least 2, if not 3 weeks, remember, we were all huddled under. It was, as Jessica said, it was even too cold to go skiing. Wasn't that cold enough to kill off the ticks?
It should have been, but if number of them are going to survive, and they're going to thrive when we start getting some warmer temperatures. 70-degree days in February are only going to benefit them.
Well, more emails from our listeners. Again, gardeners and people who observe nature are sending us their questions. Lynn says, I heard Laura mention an April snowstorm. A few years ago, we had a May snowstorm. Because my lilacs were already in leaf and a young pear tree, too, they both broke. Ordinarily sturdy, the snow on leaves made too much weight. That was a late snowstorm for sure. Lynn, thank you. And I remember that Snowtober that somebody mentioned earlier, Elizabeth, was also a problem because the trees still had their leaves on. A lot of them hadn't fallen off yet like they do in, you know, later in the fall. And that was tough. They had these leaves with, you know, heavy wet snow on them. Here's another email from Elaine who says, I moved to Grafton 12 years ago. When I moved, I thought the little red squirrels here were so cute. I was surprised to realize I wasn't seeing any of the gray squirrels that I was used to in upstate New York, Rhode Island, and Mass. For the first time this year, I saw a gray squirrel on my property. Is this population change related to climate change or just coincidental? Now, Elizabeth, I'm not going to put you on the spot because you're not a gray squirrel or a red squirrel expert, but I do wonder about the migration patterns or the settlement patterns of animals and birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could expect to see some changes in the populations that either are going to continue to stick around throughout the winter when normally they might head south, or populations that we normally don't see here just making this place their home. We had some Carolina wrens that nested in our petunia basket a number of years ago, and I had submitted my observations to eBird, which is a citizen science program, and they had me double check. I had to send in a photo to say, yep, indeed, they are Carolina wrens.
Wow. Carolina as in North Carolina and South Carolina. Yeah. Well, and speaking of birds, Robert in Epsom says, this winter we had 6 bluebirds hanging out all winter. They ate some of the droppings that the woodpeckers knocked off the hanging fat cakes, but they really liked a mealworm gelatin cake we put on a platter. So bluebirds must be not usual, usually spotted in New Hampshire in the winter. We talked earlier, Elizabeth, about you kind of being bummed. You're a mom, you're a winter lover, and just how it feels to see this season that you love so much change so much. I want to close on an upbeat note. This is an email from Henry, who sent this to both of us. He says, Laura and Elizabeth, I am a UNH grad, BA Poli Sci, MS Natural Resources. I now work in New Hampshire for the nonprofit New Hampshire Sustainable Energy Association. Henry says, I am also bummed about losing our winters, but in my job, I see so many solution stories, cities and towns investing in renewable energy, biomass, solar, efficiency. Henry says, it's clear that the solutions for counteracting climate change are building a prosperous local economy. And that makes me hopeful. Henry, thank you so much for the email. And Elizabeth, thank you also for being with us. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Burakowski, Research Assistant Professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.